Well, the new album, I think, was more of a return to perhaps the old energy of the band. I think with Maiden, when you're dealing with a style of music and an identity with the band that's pretty well known by the fans and by everybody that listens to the music, you don't want to be going off at too many like crazy tangents all the time because people can't keep up.
Enthusiastic, yeah. And we was really fine. You know, we hadn't played for like about a year and a half as well, so we had that. And also Yannick coming into the band, he had so much energy and enthusiasm. It sort of, you know, reflected on us as well, I think, the attitude.
If you would tell me just what my life means, walking along.
It was recorded in a barn, in a place that we all knew, with a place that we rehearsed, and there was an attitude that we were really going to do something and kick everybody's backsides on this album. We didn't record it actually in any way differently to the way we normally do things, in that we put everything down live. The only thing that was different was the fact that we used a mobile to record it on, and we did it in this barn. All the difference in sound and the difference in feel comes because it's real.
I think this album's pretty different, really. I mean, it's very different than the last album. It's probably more energy-wise related to some of the earlier stuff we've done. But I think it stands up on its own as a different album anyway. I mean, we don't really take too much notice of what people think, really. I mean, you listen to them or whatever and you take note to a certain extent, but at the end of the day, we've got to be happy with it. We've got to go out and look at the audience in the eye and have conviction with what we're playing.
Writing of the album came together, very quickly. We allowed ourselves 3 months because we thought, hey, it's a really important album. And I suppose it took about a month for all the songs.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and we've made it to the epic years, and I don't mean epic as in Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner epic. I mean epic as in Iron Maiden's new record label in the U.S. at least. I'm not even sure why they switched labels, except because they stayed the same everywhere else, I think. But they switched in the U.S. And today we're going to talk about the last two albums of the first Bruce Dickinson era, No Prayer for the Dying and Fear of the Dark. And for this episode, I'm joined by my favorite side of the coin, Mark Cecchini.
Thank you, Brian.
Three Sides of the Coin, Kiss Podcast. Yeah, hey, Mark, thanks for joining in on this. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, well, Lord knows it's been a hard time making the time for both of us. Jeez, we've been trying to do this for the last week or so, and I apologize, but my life is quite a busy one, and I'm very happy that it's quite a busy one, but it's busy nonetheless. So happy to make time for you to talk about one of my favorite bands. I love Iron Maiden. Been a big Maiden fan from literally day one.
Yeah, you want to tell us your story as far as Iron Maiden goes?
Well, you know, as I say on Three Sides all the time, timeline is everything. Go back to 1980. A 15-year-old Mark Cecchini, nice third-person reference there, I was really, really getting into music. I've already been into music. When I was growing up in Detroit, it was hard not to be bitten by the rock and roll bug. It was everywhere here. And I had older brother and older sister. So, and a big thing to do before, keep in mind, kids, this is before internet and all this other shit, was roller skating. And the most fun thing to do to roller skating was listen to the DJ play at the roller rink all the music. And one of my earliest earliest memories was skating up to the guy and requesting stuff like Deep Purple and Alice Cooper and Bachman Turner Overdrive. Now, this is pre-Kiss, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, requesting Smoke on the Water. I remember requesting Elected. It would have been 73. I remember the Bachman Turner Overdrive. I think You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, I think, was 74. And I had, like I said, I had an older brother, older sister. My older brother was into Kiss, brought home Hotter Than Hell when it was new. And, you know, by the time I was 9 or 10 years old, forget it. I mean, that's all. I liked three things in life at day when I was 10 years old. I liked hockey. I liked music, and I liked sports. And music went along really with all of them. You know, it was fun to always turn it up loud. So anyways, fast forward to 1980. My favorite band in the whole world put out this record called Unmasked. And I remember going, oh, boy, what happened here? You know, in the year previous, Dynasty. Now, keep in mind, I like both of these records, but, you know, compare them to the contemporaries, Ted Nugent and Judas Priest and you know, Black Sabbath and Ozzy's first record in 1980, his first solo record. That's the stuff I was gravitating to, and I really started to, and I spent a lot of time at record stores, and they always had as import magazines stuff like The Sounds and what was that, Record Mirror maybe. Anyways, I always read those. You know, I was like 15, and when I was 15, I was in boarding school in Canada. The record stores in Canada got all the stuff from England. So it was like, you know, it was a totally unique perspective from the one I was used to in the United States. Make long story short, I started reading magazines like Kerrang and, like I said, Sounds and everything. And I started seeing this, you know, crazy stuff on bands like, you know, Saxon and stuff. Then lo and behold, one day I'm at the record store and I'm just thumbing through the imports. And I see this ghastly fucking rotting corpse. And I'm like, and it literally, I like almost jumped back because I was flipping through the records and I'm like, holy shit, what's this? And I'm like, all right, if the music is as cool as the cover, and I thought to myself too, I'm like, this is too disturbing to be punk. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I didn't think this would sound like the Sex Pistols. I just kept looking at it. And then I remember flipping it over and I'm like, these guys look like a rock and roll band, you know, something I could get into. That's it, man. I've been a fan ever since. First time I saw Maiden, they were an opening band, what's this band called? Judas Priest. You've heard of them, I'm sure. They were opening for Judas Priest. It was the first time I saw them. And then, just to show how things have changed, the next time I saw them was on the Peace of Mind tour. Now, the tour of Judas Priest, it was the Number of the Beast tour. And then when I saw them on the Peace of Mind tour, I'm sure you're not from Detroit, but I'm sure you're familiar with Cobo Hall. Mm-hmm. Cobo Hall was a big place to buy or to go see concerts. Cobo Hall held 12,500, sold out. They had a concert series called Half House. So they'd cut Cobo in half. And I saw, I think it was Fastway, Coney Hatch, who was from Canada, who was really good that night, as was Fastway. And Maiden. I mean, you were almost on top of the band no matter where you sat. So then I've seen Maiden pretty much every tour since then, if not every time, for the sake of arguing, I've seen Maiden every time they've toured Detroit on every tour since Number of the Beast. And really quick, I remember when I saw them open for Number of the Beast. Keep in mind, I already had the first two records. And when I saw them, I remember being really disappointed. And I remember when I initially bought Number of the Beast, I was very disappointed because it didn't have that punky spirit. Say what you will about it, but if you go back, revisionist history is what I think a lot of Maiden fans do now. But if you're from the start like I was, the first two records really have a punk element to them. The songs are shorter. They're a lot more aggressive, both lyrically and musicality. It's, you know, it was a lot more aggressive. And I think, don't get me wrong, I love Nico McBrain. I've been a fan of his since, you know, I'm a big Pat Travers fan too, and he played with Pat. And, you know, Nico's a fantastic drummer. But the first incarnate, Clive Burr to me is, he really, you know, listen to stuff like Genghis Khan and stuff like that. I mean, that, those first two records, his drumming is just so good. Like I said, they were a lot heavier and harder. And shortly after, I started really listening to Number of the Beast. I liked it. And then, but I almost had the same problem too with Peace of Mind. I remember the first time I listened to that, I remember that, what song is the one where they're, long ago where dinosaurs walked the earth? I'm like, oh, you gotta be fucking kidding. This is terrible. Again, to me, Bruce is still the new guy. You know, I mean, I would not hear Deano sing about dinosaurs walking the earth. That just didn't, that, you know. So anyways, I know we're going up to Fear of the Dark, and I thought it was important for me to talk about all that to get to No Prayer for the Dying and Fear of the Dark. Because for me, the toughest thing for me as a Maiden fan was Somewhere in Time and Seventh Son were really difficult times. Those are my unmasked elder periods, if you want to compare it to Kiss. I wanted to still like the band. There was music on it I liked, but it didn't sound like the band I fell in love with. So you can imagine how happy I was when No Prayer for the Dying came out, because the songs were shorter. I think lyrically, songs like The Assassin, Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter, you know, Tail Gunner, the songs are shorter. The Attack was harder. I love that record, and it's funny, you know, a lot of Maiden fans don't. I just don't think they gave it its due. No Prayer for the Dying is in my top five favorite Maiden albums. I love, love, love this record. And the one after it, Fear of the Dark, I like. Some of it seems to me like No Prayer leftovers. But, you know, again, though, too, we don't need 11-minute songs or however long the title track is and shit. If there's one thing I could buy for Mr. Harris, it would be some editing equipment. I mean, come on, dude. It's tough to sit through. Some of those songs just have these long blinkity, 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 blinkity. It doesn't need to go on for 4 fucking minutes. It just drives me up the fucking wall. That's how come, again, first two records are my favorite. And I really like No Prayer a lot for a lot of the same reasons. I think there's a thin line between those. Whereas The Attack is full on, lyrically vicious, you know, just really, really dig that record. So also though too, we have to talk about that time in Maiden. I saw both of those tours. I think a not sold out Palace of Auburn Hills. I seem to remember, and you can see I'm doing as much prep for this show as I do for Three Sides, which is just kind of sit down and wing it. But I've been lucky to have all these great rock and roll experiences and I've seen so much. So if I have a date out of time or something, but if I remember on the, I think Anthrax opened on the, no, it was either No Prayer or Fear of the Dark. Regardless, I saw both tours, and the band really wasn't selling that well at the time. Maybe grunge had something to do with it, but, you know, they weren't packing it in like they were, you know, in years previous.
Yeah, I saw the Fear of the Dark tour, and yeah, it was like probably half full at Alpine Valley. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had definitely... I mean, probably that, I would say that must have contributed to Bruce leaving, was just the fact that Iron Maiden, they were out, at least in the U.S., they were, I think they were still always huge everywhere else, but yeah, from a U.S. perspective, they had really dropped significantly.
We'll be right back.
here was something that I think is kind of weird. I always loved their B-sides, and that was like one of the first times where I noticed something in the band. When they did the Montrose song, the Space Station number 5, Bruce wasn't taking it serious. Where they, you know, if you listen to the earlier ones, you know, those were pretty, they were, you know, taking the everything serious. I mean, you know, the Nodding Donkey Blues. And keep in mind, I love this stuff, but it didn't have the attack of the previous B-sides. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was just losing his way, and he was just, I don't know. I always, in my head, because this is, you know, this podcast is really where we can sit down and talk minutia. You know, could you see them doing like the Nodding Donkey Blues, or the, how they totally screw, it's mostly Bruce screwing up Space Station with the long rambling thing. Could you have seen him do that, you know, on Number of the Beast, on those B-sides?
No.
No, you wouldn't have. He wanted to kick ass and take names. And here, I think maybe he was just taking the piss, as they say in England. I've read read enough English magazines in my life to understand their lingo. You know, he was taking the piss out of it. Just didn't fucking care. Nobody.
Well, Seventh Son of a Seventh Son had been the band's most successful album everywhere in the world except in the U.S., but they had this big drop in their popularity in the U.S. starting with that album. And plus, they were really happy with the record artistically and creatively from everything you read. They were really proud of that record. So it seems like, yet they were so fixated on success in the U.S. that even though Seventh Son was huge, I mean, they had 4 top 10 singles in the UK from Seventh Son.
That's something I want to touch on too, but Can I Play With Madness? To this day, I have a hard time with that song. It's not, again, not because it's bad. It's just that wasn't the band I fell in love with. Which is kind of like when I talk about Kiss with like Heaven's on Fire. I always look at stuff like this. Being that, you know, look, you guys, whoever's watching this that knows who I am from Three Sides, okay, then this analogy will make sense. I always take songs from eras and see if they would relate to my favorite eras. I don't think that Can I Play With Madness would have fit on Killers or the first record. I don't even think it would have fit on the first 5 records. So in some ways, it's a new band, and I'm not a fan of that. Much like when I on Kiss, when I see songs like, or listen to songs like Under the Gun, well, it's a cool song, just like Can I Play With Madness is a cool song, I guess. But would that have fit on their first 3 records? Seriously, think about that. If you're an Iron Maiden lackey crazy fan, which I am, can I honestly say that Can I Play With Madness, could that have fit on Killers? And where would it fit? Does it have that feel? The answer is no, it doesn't. Doesn't fit at all. So in a lot of ways, as the band progressed, and certainly the prog element was really, really, really heavy on Seventh Son, really heavy, especially compared to the first, you know, 3-4 records. It wasn't what I fell in love with. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Yeah, since you were a fan from the very first album, it's a very different perspective as they progress.
It is. In my opinion, it was tough to stay a fan through those years. But again, look, there's plenty to love. I love Moonchild, you know. The Evil That Men Do is one of my favorite Iron Maiden songs. You know, it's good. It's just not the same.
Yeah, yeah, I love Seventh Son, and we heaped a lot of praise on it last week, and I also said Evil That Men Do is one of my favorite Iron Maiden songs. I mean, that song's just all melody, and it's great.
Oh, it is.
But yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. I like Can I Play With Madness, but it's such a simple song, and yeah, it barely resembles Iron Maiden, except just the lyrics, I guess. I mean, the fact that it's called Can I Play With Madness makes it an Iron Maiden song, just because that wouldn't have been a Motley Crue lyric. But otherwise, it's probably closer to Motley Crue or something than Maiden, yeah.
Which I guess is my point. Again, I don't hate it. It's just not what made me a fan of Iron Maiden to begin with. You know, and there's lots of bands, you know, like that as you listen to their catalog. Obviously, I'm going to go back to the Stalwart Kiss. You know, songs like Torpedo Girl wouldn't have fit on the first six Kiss records, but it's quirky, it's fun, you know. It is what it is. I don't hate it. I dig it, but it's, again, it's not an example of what I'd give somebody. Like, what made you an Iron Maiden fan? I wouldn't give them, you know, Can I Play With Madness? That's not what, you know, I'd give them Wrathchild.
I just think it's so strange, though, that when you look at this from a U.S. perspective, it does seem like Iron Maiden, you know, their career was at like a low point at this point. But in the rest of the world, it wasn't. They were huge. So it's funny that obviously success in America was so important to them that even though Seventh Son was huge and they were really proud of it, they made such a drastic shift to the next album and just, you know, made a completely different sounding record on a different label in America. And it just seems like they were so focused on, you know, success in America, which obviously that is, you know, that's where you can have the most success if you're successful. And that's where you can sell the most albums and everything. But it's just strange that even though Seventh Son was so successful everywhere else and they loved it creatively and artistically, they're still, you know, they're just worried about being big in America. And so they strip everything down. And of course, 1990, I mean, in between Seventh Son, we had Adrian Smith does a solo project. Bruce Dickinson does a solo project. Both of them are huge departures from the Iron Maiden sound. So everything was just kind of weird when they reconvened to make this next album. And what I found really interesting when I was researching this, which I didn't realize before, Adrian was there at the beginning of No Prayer for the Dying. He was still in the band. He didn't leave when he did ASAP. That was just like a side project. And it sure seems like from reading the quotes from Adrian and from Bruce, it sure seems like Adrian didn't leave as much as Bruce or as Steve Harris. I said Bruce, I think. Reading the quotes from Adrian and Steve, it seems like it was more Steve Harris saying, yeah, you don't really seem like you're into this anymore. You know, maybe you should leave. It really seems like it was more of a push from Steve Harris for him to leave than he just left on his own. I think Adrian Smith was really torn about whether or not he wanted to leave. And Steve Harris was like, well, if you're not sure you want to be here, then maybe you should just leave, you know?
That's true. It's funny, too. But you can really hear on No Prayer, Hooks in You, you can just tell by listening to that song, it's an Adrian Smith song. It's funny, too, you bring up something that I like to bring up on all the time at Three Sides about when people accuse Kiss of being a sellout and, you know, all money grubbing assholes. And let's face it, if you have people who listen to this podcast or just Iron Maiden fans, they may even have that bias if you want. But the fact of the matter is, and it's an honest assessment, making it means making it in the United States. That's what making it meant.
Yeah.
And there's no shame in that because these guys are trying to, you know, make a living. Look, it's, you can claim it's all art. It's not, but it's not, because if it was, Steve Harris never would have left his basement and would have had the coolest collection of cassettes ever that, you know, he could have listened to over and over. No, he wanted world domination. He wanted to take his passion and dominate the world of music. And he did just that, but he needed to crack the United States. Here was a band that just a year or two earlier were playing to sold out concert, you know, arenas all over the world. Now, I think people in America were maybe seeing, you know, I saw it last time or I saw the last couple tours, I don't need to go. But eventually they, you know, rebranded and were able to do it again. My point is that all bands ebb and flow. You know what I mean? Look at Maiden just a couple years later with Blaze. Now, keep in mind, from the time I first saw Maiden at Kobo, the year previous, and I was at boarding school, so I couldn't go, I was already a fan of Killers. They played at Harpo's, which is a larger sized bar here, usually held about like 1,500 people to maybe 2,000. Then I saw them at Kobo with Judas Priest, full Kobo, 12,500. Following year, I saw them at Half House Kobo, which was like 6,000. Then I saw them, you know, every year after that, either at Pine Knob, which is around 15,000, to the Palace or Joe Louis, you know, which were around 20,000 seat arenas. Well, the Palace, 20,000 seat. And when I saw this tour, No Prayer, you know, it was only about 2/3 full. And I think Fear of the Dark was even less than that. Maybe, I can't remember. I know Anthrax was one. I want to say that Megadeth was one on those tours too. But again, I'm just going strictly off my memory. I could be wrong. So, and you could tell too, especially on the Fear of the Dark tour, Bruce really, you could tell he was going through the motions. At least someone like myself who had seen it from the first time I saw him, you know, at Kobo on the Number of the Beast tour. By the time, you know, seeing him on the Fear of the Dark tour, it was a guy who was clearly was not as, he didn't seem happy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you're a fan of Iron Maiden, you may hate the word happy because it's not metal, but Bruce is a happy guy on stage. I mean, you know, making the little sarcastic cracks, very much like Ian Gillan from Deep Purple does. You know, this is what not to do when a bird shits on you and, you know, stuff like, in other words, he's not always, you know, he's not a negative guy. He's always trying to have a little bit of fun. And he certainly seemed, the word dour, by the way, that's a very English word, but he seemed dour on that tour. Did you, Brian, did you see that? You saw the Fear of the Dark tour?
Yeah, I saw it twice. Yeah, I can remember. Yeah, just the whole vibe was kind of depressing because there was nobody there. And yeah, the record seemed like it was a flop. And it sure wasn't surprising that Bruce left after that. You could kind of see the writing on the wall, I think, at that point. And plus, that was 92, 93. That was a crazy time in America for rock music in general. I mean, you know, yeah, Iron Maiden were, they were definitely on their way out in America in a lot of different ways at that point. And you definitely felt it, for sure, I remember.
Well, you know, it's funny because Maiden was one of those bands that kind of got a pass by the hair metal gang, if you want to call that, people who said they were into metal. It's funny because I almost thought that Iron Maiden was almost like Motorhead because I'm a huge fan of both. But the people I'd see at some of the clubs, and keep in mind, this, again, for the younger viewers and stuff, you know, this is before the internet. Just think of a life with no internet at all. You know, people went to clubs. That was what you did on a Saturday night. You packed the clubs and you met people. And, you know, it was the internet without with having to interact with people. And you would gravitate to people who were dressed like you. If you wore the shirts that, you know, you wore or whatever. Quick story, but it relates to this. The band that I'm in now, I met my guitar player, who I'm in a band with now. We became friends before we were bandmates. But we were both in college, I'll never forget, he was wearing like a Saxon t-shirt, and I think I was wearing a Twisted Sister t-shirt. And keep in mind, it's 1983, and we used to cross each other's paths, and no one else in school wore, you know, at college was wearing a jean vest over a leather and stuff. But we just, and next thing you know, we became friends. And that's kind of what I'm talking about with the hair metal crowd going back. If you saw somebody at the club that was wearing a Maiden shirt, you'd go talk to them. But I noticed that some of the people back in the hair metal days, they'd wear a Motorhead or an Iron Maiden just because they knew it was metal, but they really weren't fans. And I remember that bummed me out when I wanted to talk shop, I guess, with but seeing those were the two bands, I think, that got a pass from people who were into the MTV metal, if you wanted to call it that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was more image generated than it really was music generated. That was one of the great things that I was, you know, earlier in the conversation, when I was reading Kerrang and Sounds and stuff like that, those people really knew the music. They wanted everything to be about music. And Maiden was all about the music. You know, don't get me wrong, the Eddie thing and everything, that was, you know, that was just the icing on the cake. But the tunes were there. You know what I mean? When you listen to, The Trooper, you know, you felt that, you know. You felt that. That's something I don't think you felt with, you know, I don't know, the MTV metal, I guess.
Yeah, I think, like you were mentioning, Anthrax and Megadeth opening for them, I think that's really where a lot of their fans went in the late 80s, early 90s. Iron Maiden, in America at least, they weren't heavy enough as heavy metal fans started moving more towards thrash metal and stuff like that. I think, you know, the novelty of Iron Maiden as the heavy band, you know, they were kind of left in the dust by Metallica, Anthrax, Megadeth. And a lot of the people that liked Iron Maiden a couple years earlier probably didn't really care anymore. And they were more into thrash metal at that point, 1990, 92, you know?
Well, I was a big tape trader. And it's funny, you just reminded me of a great story. I had a job that I worked at this wood cutting factory. And one of the guys I just ended up kind of gravitating to because he was it's a fellow hard rock guy. And I remember he'd never heard of Metallica yet. I remember at lunch, it was right when, cause I was just out of college then, I was in college, just out of high school. I remember I brought Ride the Lightning. It was brand new. And at lunch I played it for him. And I remember he turned to me and he says, Iron Maiden's not heavy anymore.
Right.
We just finished listening to Fight Fire with Fire, if you're familiar with that song, uh-huh. Off of The Lightning. And yeah, that was where his exact words. He turned to me and said that Iron Maiden's not heavy anymore. You know, this is the new heavy, and it was. I mean, again, the new wave of British heavy metal, you know, from Saxon and sorry, Joe Elliott, early Def Leppard. I mean, it was heavier than a lot of the, you know, the traditional rock stuff. And it, let's face it, the new wave of British heavy metal is really what morphed into Metallica. They took it to the nth degree. And then after that, forget it, from Slayer to Megadeth to Testament to all those bands, which I absolutely love. It was a different world after that.
Yeah. And you were talking about meeting a guy because he was wearing a Saxon shirt. And basically that's why Metallica exists, because Brian Slagle saw Lars Ulrich, I think Brian Slagle and John Kernarans, they saw Lars Ulrich wearing a Saxon shirt at some show. They went up to him and basically started the process that culminated in Metallica. It was a Saxon shirt, yeah, because it was the time period.
Like I said, it's cool that you have a story like that, because that happened to me dozens and dozens of times.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of stories like that from back then where people would meet just because there were so few people that liked those bands at that time in the early 80s. So if you saw somebody with that shirt, you were like, hey, I would be friends with that guy. You just knew right just because of the shirt. Yeah.
Well, I was a big tape trader. I had the No Life to Leather. You know, I had all that stuff. I was really into it. I remember buying the Kaufman and Kaufman first Motley Crue record. You know, in a lot of ways, I'm that guy, you know, if you want to. I was just, that was my thing. That was my scene. I was so into it. And again, that's, you know, earlier in the conversation, I was saying how I had so much. I think we talked about this before we hit record, but you know, a few years back, my wife's like, can you just concentrate on one band? Because I was so into so many other bands, and I still am into them. I just don't collect every freaking poster and, you know, t-shirt anymore like I used to.
Yeah.
With the exception of Kiss, of course. But, but you know, I really into Maiden, you know, from day one. And much like Kiss, I followed them through the highs and lows. This to me, you know, get back to what, you know, initially we're talking about. Not so much Fear of the Dark, but to me, No Prayer was a return to the band that I loved after an era of that I really didn't like so much. Now, that's another great thing about meeting people like you, Brian, because I meet them in Kiss circles all the time, where there's Kiss guys who think that, you know, Asylum's their best record. And let's face it, it's just a matter of taste. I'm glad they feel that way. It's just not my reference point. I'll say the same thing about Seventh Son. I like it. It's cool. But that's not why I fell in love with the band. And I thought that No Prayer was why I fell in love with the band. It was a nice, songs were shorter, lyrically a little bit more intense. And that drifted on, and I'd hope you agree, I hope you and the audience would agree, would Beat Quick or Be Dead in everybody, would that be in everybody's top 10 favorite Maidens? It is with me. I fuck, man. That tune to me is, that's Maiden, man. I love that tune.
Yeah, No Prayer for the Dying, you know, I have a couple of quotes. Adrian, like I was saying, Adrian Smith was actually a part of it, that record at the beginning, which I didn't realize. But his quote was, the vibe was, let's make a real raw-sounding album, and I didn't want to do that. I thought we were heading in the right direction with the last two albums, and it was a step backwards to strip it all down again. So basically Adrian saying the opposite of what you're saying, which is... But I also, Bruce Dickinson said, describing No Prayer for the Dying, he said, it was shit. It was a shit-sounding record. That's what Bruce said later. So,
here's something interesting just to chew on. Had it been a big hit, you think that would be his? You think that would be his?
No,
I don't think so either. Again, we brought it up in Timeline. It was just a tough time for this genre of music.
Yeah.
What you put, they could have put out Number of the Beast, then it would have suffered the same fate.
Fear of the Dark was much more right in the middle of the whole grunge thing. No Prayer for the Dying, it was, I mean, everything was kind of weird in 1990, but it really hadn't, all changed. The way, you know, 1992 is very different already from even 1990, from what I remember. I mean, just look, because 91 is when both Nevermind and Pearl Jam 10 came out, I think. So in between No Prayer and Fear of the Dark, that's when the whole, in America, everything just went nuts. And so Iron Maiden, I think they were just completely confused, because they had their moment in the U.S. where they were really big, and then... I think they were just really confused as to why they weren't. They probably didn't understand the concept of all the thrash metal kids who didn't really care about them anymore. And I think they were probably just disconnected from why they had big success in the U.S. And then from their point of view, for no reason, it just went away. And I don't think they understood what happened.
Well, you remember, too, the kids who, much like the guy I played when he said, wow, Maiden's not heavy anymore. Look, a lot of those kids then, and I mean kids, you know, teenagers, like how I was when I first got into, you know, Kiss and Nugent and Purple and stuff. I think kids then, meaning kids that were maybe 15 in 1990, you know, you started having that punk element thrown in through bands like Megadeth, because Megadeth and Metallica and Testament, you could tell they had that punk edge, much though too, like the original Maiden stuff had that punky edge to it. And what you just said, by what Adrian Smith said, he wanted more of the prog, whereas Steve was like, you know, let's go back to stripping it all down, if I read your quote correct.
Yeah.
So you know, you've got some infighting there too. And like I said, going to the next record, Yannick, what did he write? Probably two or three songs on that record.
I think he's a co-writer on like five songs of Fear of the Dark.
My point is, you know, he started to contribute and it was cool. That record, you know, let's concentrate a little bit on Fear of the Dark. Afraid to Shoot Strangers, one of my favorite melodies on in their catalog. I like that one a lot. There's also, I don't know, there's a lot of filler on this record. From Here to Eternity is all right. Just trying to name some songs off the top of my head. The title track, it's funny. I always think I hate it till I play it live, and then I find myself jumping up and down by the end of it. I'm such an idiot. Because for some reason, I'm like, I really don't like that song, but I guess I do. I don't know if you have any songs like that.
Yeah, I would definitely Fear the Dark's probably more fun live. It's kind of a classic sounding Maiden song, but it's, you know, it would not have stood out on an earlier record, I don't think.
Well, it's funny, they still play it, and I still remember my heart drops every time they start it, and then by the end I'm jumping around like a fool. I'm all happy they're playing it. I did that this past tour. My kid, I'm like, oh, why do I have to play this again? And by the end, I'm like, fear all the time. I'm like, my kids,
yeah.
You know, my son's 24, and that's another thing, you know. I love the fact that I can share my love of Maiden and, you know, Aerosmith and Kiss and all these bands with my son. And that's one thing one of my son's friends is really into a lot of the black death metal and stuff. And I'm like, just can't see. And I remember telling his buddy, I'm like, you know, with Maiden and stuff, you'll be able to share that with your kids someday. I just don't think you're going to be able to share that, you know, with your kid, when at least I don't I couldn't see it anywhere. But, you know, Maiden, you know, everywhere, everything from the artwork to the story to the, you know, to the different highs and lows. It's fun to share with somebody. You know what I mean? Fun to, you know, here it is. I'm 51 years old and, you know, I was getting into them when I was 15. So it's, you know, been a fun time on Planet Maiden, if you know what I mean. A lot of highs and lows. And I just saw them last April, which I think is probably going to be their last time touring. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so No Prayer for the Dying was, I was supposed to be stripped down, I guess. But then the production on Fear of the Dark, I think, is pretty terrible. And I think Steve Harris did most of the production on that. I think they brought Martin Birch in to maybe try to fix it. But I think there's a lot of problems with Fear of the Dark with the production. Some of the songs could be a lot better, like From Here to Eternity, Chains of Misery. They could be a lot better if they weren't kind of ruined by the production, I think.
Well, don't you think something, and I believe it's Chains of Misery, that doesn't really even sound like a Maiden song.
No, it's just a rock song. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's kind of my point, though. It's the chorus sounds like it could be a Motley Crue chorus. You know what I mean? It doesn't sound like the band I fell in love with. That's how come that one's iffy. But again, like I said earlier, Be Quick or Be Dead, Here to Eternity, Afraid to Shoot Strangers, I think those are songs that could have been maybe some of, to me, like leftovers from the previous record. And I love the previous record. Whereas stuff like Wasting Love and Chains of Misery, I guess, you know, another, the Apparition, isn't that?
It's really bad.
Like a pseudo rap song. It's like,
it's really bad.
Do you follow me with that?
Yeah.
The way lyrics are delivered on that, it's like, Bruce, what are you doing?
No, I think I wrote down that on Fear of the Dark, there's two songs, Fear is the Key and The Apparition, that for me compete as possibly being the worst Iron Maiden song ever.
I'm glad we see things together there, Brian. I'm with you, too. Those songs just don't make sense. They don't make sense in the context of Iron Maiden, to me.
And I think both of those are Bruce and Yannick wrote those. Actually, and they also wrote Wasting Love and Weekend Warrior, which are both terrible as well. They're just really bad.
With Ted, he won't let you down. I'm not familiar if you're a... The Weekend Warrior tune is awesome.
That's a great Nugent album, yeah.
That's really good. It's funny, too, and I knew it wasn't, but I remember the first time, I'm like, there's no way they covered this. And sure enough, yeah. So,
Well, even looking at No Prayer for the Dying, there's... My favorite song on that record is Fate's Warning, probably.
That's a great... See, that is really a classic Maiden-sounding song, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
A favor with some fresh ears, go listen to No Prayer for the Dying, because unlike Fear of the Dark, like Brian and I just said, you know, you're going to find some crappers like The Apparition and stuff like you're gonna, I don't honestly, in my heart of hearts, if you're a fan of the first three or four Maiden records, which are mostly considered their classic era, you're gonna like, I think you're gonna like No Prayer for the Dying. Give it another chance. It's really that good, especially, you know, Tail Gunner. Oh my God, what a classic Maiden song that is. The whole record's just dynamite. I like that record so much.
Well, Tail Gunner is a good song, but don't you kind of think that having the first song on the record be about fighter pilots again was kind of like, okay, this is kind of an Iron Maiden cliche at this point.
Well, if you want to go back to the hottest band in the world, I mean, they kind of did that with... you know, Creatures of the Night, and then the next one had Exciter, which were kind of sister songs, you know, Under the Gun. And, you know, I guess maybe the reason I do like it, Brian, so much is that it much like Aces High, it's what I love about them.
Yeah.
It's not corny, and it's not a bad song. It's a dynamite song, and the lyrics are dynamite. You got to shoot the Fooker thing. That's fucking awesome. I remember the first time... Yeah, you know what I mean? It's what I wanted. You know what I mean? That's what I wanted from Maiden. I don't want the Apparition. I wanted fucking Tail Gunner. And yeah, I got it.
Tail Gunner has all the classic elements of an Iron Maiden song, that's for sure. But I think that's kind of what... it almost turns into self-parody at some point. Like, I think Mother Russia, it's like, okay, we need the epic album closer. But at this point, it's like, yeah, but this is almost paint by numbers. It's like Steve Harris, you know, it's got to have this and this and this. But well, at some point, that just gets too ridiculous.
Well, tell you what, I'm guilty as charged here. Another band I'm just fucking crazy about is AC/DC.
Yeah.
You want to talk about self-parody?
Yeah.
I don't care. That's why I like them. Another band I mentioned earlier, Motorhead.
Yeah.
Look, there's a reason I love them, and there's parts where I don't. When he started, what's the album? It was right around this time. Like Hellraiser. That's horrible. That doesn't sound like fucking, you know, anything. When Lemmy and Company, like the Don't Tell Daddy Kissed Me or whatever, that fucking bullshit from the early 90s and Hellraiser, when they were trying not to sound like Motorhead, I didn't like it. Which is the same thing with Iron Maiden. When they started going prog, they weren't, that's the I didn't fall in love with a prog band. I fell in love with a metal punky band. That's what I fell in love with.
Yeah.
When they started going away from that, same thing with AC/DC. I really didn't like Razor's Edge with Money Talks and stuff. They were trying too hard to have an American hit instead of, they weren't trying hard to have an American hit with Highway to Hell. That's just who they were. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
When it's contrived and it's not genuine, that's when I kind of lose interest. And I think that's, you know, part of the problem that I had with, you know, maybe Seven, not so much Seven,
Somewhere in Time, probably.
Somewhere in Time is just, to this day, don't get me wrong, again, Heaven Can Wait's a dynamite song. I love that song. But do you really ever just fast, you know, go to the fucking, you know, Loneliness of the Long Distance Run? I never would. I'd fall asleep. It's terrible. I just can't get into that. You know, just, I want to rock, damn it. It's, you know.
But I remember seeing Holy Smoke, you know, when it debuted on Headbangers Ball, and it was kind of jarring at the time. For one thing, Bruce, his vocals are so different. He's doing that gruff kind of voice, which, you know, you do hear it on earlier albums, but I remember it was really, he did it for the whole song, which was weird. And it really is. Holy Smoke, there's not a lot of Iron Maiden in that song either. It's just kind of a stripped-down rock song. And that was the first single, so that was kind of a, I don't know, well, it was an odd intro to the album, I remember.
Well, for me, it's that song, you know, I'm also a Christian, but I'm not one of those beat-you-over-the-head-with-a-cross Christians. I'm a Catholic guy, and, you know, I went to Catholic school. I'm, you know, consider myself pretty religious. But that's the kind of stuff that I loved when my favorite kind of music exposed, you know, the people who I think are not very Christian who call themselves Christian, you know.
Yeah.
I was very happy when that kind of stuff comes out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When my favorite bands, you know, mock those assholes, because those people have, it's the complete opposite of what Christianity stands for. He's right. Those people are a bunch of scumbags, you know, and I don't want to get off on a whole nother tangent, but when I see those mega churches, and even today when people, you know, fill up the Silver Dome, that's closed, but these big domes, I mean, that's not what it's about, man. That's not what it's about. Take the money and go give it, do it silently. Go help people. You don't need to stand on the corners as the hypocrites do, as it says in the Bible. You know, do that stuff privately. So I love that. That song to this day still means a lot to me. I thought he nailed it lyrically on that song, and I think they nailed it. Just everything about that song is cool. I like that song a lot.
I would say of these two albums, my favorite song is Judas Be My Guide from Fear of the Dark. That's my favorite song of all the songs on these two records.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's the one I still go back to and listen to. But anyway, it's right up my alley because it's a upbeat like pop metal song with a really hooky chorus. So it's just I like that song a lot.
When I brought up The Apparition, I was this close to bringing up Judas Be My Guide. It's the other one.
Yeah, I don't think it's a lot of other people's favorite, but
really?
Yeah, I like that one.
Living in a world of darkness.
I think Fear of the Dark, a lot of Fear of the Dark, half of that album is terrible. So it's all those Bruce and Yannick songs. I mean, they Be Quick or Be Dead they wrote with the, and that, you know, that's a good song. But all the other ones they did, I think it's Fear is the Key, Wasting Love, Apparition, and Weekend Warrior, they're all terrible.
Oh, I'm with you. Everyone you just listed, I don't like either.
Yeah. So. And I think, well, I know Wasting Love they had been working on for Tattooed Millionaire. And that's like, that was Iron Maiden's attempt at like a power ballad. And I remember them doing that song on the Fear of the Dark tour, and it was just awful.
Well, what do you think of Afraid to Shoot Strangers? To me, that actually could have been on Seventh Son, because it really has that melodic. That's just a cool melody. That song kind of hooked me in right away. And I thought that really – actually, you know what? I think Afraid to Shoot Strangers would have fit better on Peace of Mind, maybe. It just has that melody to it. It always reminds me of that era of Maiden. I like that song a lot.
And I like Childhood's End, too. I think it's bad production, but I think it's got a really good chorus and great guitar work. There's just – I think the production is kind of a problem, but that's a really cool song.
Dark didn't even go gold.
No, it didn't. Yeah, it was number one in the UK, number one album in the UK, but in the US it didn't even go gold. So
wow.
And Be Quick or Be Dead was number two single in the UK.
If I remember, didn't Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter, didn't that chart really high?
Number one. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I was gonna say, I remember that was real successful, because I just thought it was funny at the time that a song with that title would, you know, do well. Also, while we're on this record, that Golden Earring cover, I love the B-side, the Kill Me, Say Soir, or whatever. That fucking cover was incredible.
Song called Kill Me from Vic 10's last LP.
too much of a risk for a golden disc. The price he paid for money. Ce soir, ce soir. Shake it!
I dig this. Hopefully people here will maybe give this classic another chance. I think they're going to be happy with songs like Tail Gunner and Public Enema Number One. That's another great one. Fate's Warning. Hooks and Use really got a great vibe to it. And I don't know, Mother Russia's classic Maiden. I mean, there's, man, I think everything that anyone ever liked about Maidens, there's something on this record for you.
What do you think of the title, No Prayer for the Dying, as an album title?
I guess I never thought of it before.
I remember when they announced it, like before the record came out, and I thought it was, I was just confused. It didn't seem like a great album title, but I love the cover. I love the album cover.
I thought the cover was cool because I didn't like the previous two album covers. I didn't like the previous two albums in general. Although Seventh Son's way better than Somewhere in Time.
Yeah.
It's funny now, in the last minute I clicked over and I'm like, ugh, caught Somewhere in Time. Decent song. It's just too long. Wasted Years is nice. Sea of Madness. I'm like, Loneliness of the Long Distance Run. For some reason,
you hate that song.
It's a lot shorter than I thought. You know, Alexander's the Great, the one I fucking
hate. Oh, that's really bad.
Yeah, that's 8 minutes and 35 seconds of complete misery to me.
Yeah.
Stranger in a Strange Land I like. Yeah, I just don't like this record in general. And I think it just sounds like garbage. Just tough to. Again, too, you know what? Timeline's everything. Can I say this with, I don't think there's a Maiden fan in the world that doesn't love, with a capital L, Power Slave.
Yeah.
That really is the quintessential. If you combine the first couple Deano records with the next, you know, couple Dickinson studio records, you have a nice mix of that in Power Slave. You know, everything about Power Slave is great. Another record where they're, and here's where it gets a pass. And I say this on Three Sides all the time. In order to be a music fan, you have to be a hypocrite. I love Rhyme of the Ancient Mirror. Motherfucker's almost 50 minutes. But it does have too long of a plinky plinky thing in the middle.
Yeah.
The lyrics are dynamite in that song, and I love that song. So, like I said all the time, if you're going to have a podcast and you're going to talk about music, you're going to have some chinks in your armor, meaning you're going to have some weak spots in your argument. And that's one of them for me, because I absolutely love Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. I think it's a dynamite song.
That's funny, because every Maiden fan knows exactly what you mean when you say the plinky plinky thing. But yeah, so Eddie was resurrected with the long hair on No Prayer for the Dying. And then what the hell happened to him on Fear of the Dark? He turned into a tree. And the, you know, that wasn't Derek Riggs. This guy Melvin Grant did that cover, and he did the Atrocity of Virtual 11, that album cover, which is just a nightmare. He did that too, so they actually brought him back.
You know, I bought and I own both of Blaze Bailey records. I think I listened to both of them once. I just could not get into his voice. It was funny too, talk about the arc. After playing years of, you know, Pine Knobs here in the Palace and Joe Louis, I think on that tour, I could be wrong, I think they played back at Harpo's again on one of those Blaze tours, you know, back to the 1,500 seat, you know. And again, like I said, 2016, I saw them at the Palace again, you know, back in the arena where they always play. So, you know, is what it is, I guess.
Yeah, well, Fear of the Dark was number one album in the UK. I'm sure that the tour was huge everywhere else in the world, but the US is kind of over for them. And so I guess they got Bruce to do one more tour where they talk about how the only time he actually put on a good performance was when television cameras were there. Otherwise, he just went through the motions, even though Bruce denies that. All the other band members say they were really, and I think they were really pissed off at Bruce Dickinson by the end of that tour. Because his heart just wasn't in it anymore, and he embarked on a very strange solo career with very little success. But of course, they also embarked on a very strange detour with Blaze Bailey with very little success. So I guess the coming back, the return of Bruce Dickinson eventually, and Adrian Smith, it had to be inevitable. I guess it didn't seem that way at the time he left, but it really was. He was going to be back.
I think Maiden fans everywhere just kind of, I know I always thought he was coming back.
Yeah.
You
know. But yeah, we'll get into the Blaze Bailey years on the next episode. So yeah, thanks a lot, Mark, for taking the time and talking Maiden with me.
It's been my pleasure, Brian. It was a lot of fun, not just regurgitating all my Kiss stuff, although I enjoy regurgitating all my Kiss stuff every week, three sides of the coin. So it's fun. I dig it. Like I said, anybody who doesn't know, I do a podcast called Three Sides of the Coin. It's all about Kiss, but of course, I'm always throwing in my, you know, Iron Maiden and Deep Purple and Black Sabbath references because I like them as much as I like Kiss, although Kiss is always going to be my favorite. So. All right, Brian, thank you so much for your time. Everybody out there in podcast land, thanks for listening. Hopefully you had a good time, and see you down the road, man.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Frontman Bruce Dickinson has finally bid an official farewell to Iron Maiden so he can pursue a solo career full-time. Dickinson told the UK press that his family and solo career have made it harder to give 100% to Iron Maiden. Iron Maiden bassist Steve Harris said he was surprised, to say the least, by Bruce's sudden decision, but we understand and respect his decisions, unquote. Dickinson and Iron Maiden will launch a farewell tour of England and Europe on Thursday, but there are no plans for them to tour the U.S., so it looks like the new Iron Maiden live album out this week will have to do for stateside fans. Dickinson will release a new solo album later this year, and Iron Maiden will start looking for a new frontman after this last tour is through. That's the news for now. We'll have more news later right here on MTV.
MTV News.
Accepting the decision in the first place wasn't so much a problem, but it's just, I think, you know, it was all said that, you know, he was going to go out and tour and do this tour and give 100%. And I think we all feel he hasn't been doing that, being honest about it. Some nights he does, some nights he doesn't, seems to be, you know. And that's what's really annoyed everybody. And Nico in particular, you know. Nico very much sort of took it to heart, you know. And I wasn't really sure that's the right way to take it, really. I mean, you get all sorts of mixed emotions, you know, of like, okay, annoyance, sadness or surprise or whatever. But we wasn't really totally surprised that he was going anyway. It's just the timing of it that did surprise us, because it was, you know, 3 weeks before the tour was starting. But, you know, as I said, I think, you know, because we feel that if he hasn't been going out and giving 100% on the tour, I'm sure he will on his British tour, because it's Britain, and he will do that. But I think it's not fair to some of the other countries, people in other countries, where he's not been giving it, or he'll do, you know, I think some nights when, I don't know, for example, if you were there, he would perform well, because, you know, he would think that you're important press. And if you're not there the next night, then maybe he wouldn't perform as well. And to me, that's, I think it's demeaning to himself, and I think it's an insult in a way to us and the fans. But we haven't really had a big argument with him about it, because we feel, well, you know, it's only a short tour, and very, you know, very soon he'll be going his own way and we'll go ours. But it's very disappointing, to be honest.
On my past life, and it doesn't have much time. 'Cause at 5 o'clock they take me to the gallows pole. The sands of time for me are running low.
decision earlier would have been based on ego. It would have been based on, yeah, it would have just been based on that ego, nothing else. And that's not it's a reason, but it's not a good enough reason to change your life based upon based upon your ego. I think that's crazy. You know, dictators do that, megalomaniacs. But you know, I want to do something different, and I think I can do something different and go off and make a difference in music. Before, I wasn't sure. But now it's something that I really believe I have to go and do. And if it fails, then that's okay. But I had to go and do it. You have to find out. It's only the music that made me do it.
I'll be back.